We're back with Todd Brunell, back from the shadows. That's a beautiful performance and very nice writing, and I need to ask you about how you learn to do the orchestration, how you learn to voice chords with that kind of sensitivity.
I think it just comes from playing in a lot of orchestras mm-hmm. and doing a lot of chamber music. That's sort of the other half of what I do. I am a freelance musician. And
you're not free, though.
I try not to be. I mean, you know, it's tough, though. I mean, you know, it's always tough. But, yeah, I get paid to play professionally. And play in. So I think just having a real sensitivity to the instruments, knowing what they sound like, what they're capable of, and then listening and listening and listening and listening for so long, composition is really kind of intuitive. I hear things that I like. I don't have perfect pitch. It's very difficult for me. I think it's because of playing a B-flat instrument.
Mm-hmm,
my sense of
it.
Like concert yeah. pitch is sort of like yeah. skewed. Yeah. Although it's not an excuse, because a very good friend of mine, Michael Leonard of Leonard's Music in Wayland, great place to buy a instrument, and he's an expert repairman, has perfect pitch.
That's Leonard's Music again.
Leonard's Music in Wayland,
yes, just call 323-956.
He helped me to fix my bayonet inside my clarinet.
What a trooper.
Actually, he took it out, actually. So he has perfect pitch. And he's an alto saxophonist. He's a classical sax player. So, I don't know. It's just, I love to compose. It's just, the thing is
yeah, but people loving to compose is not always equivalent to being able to compose.
Right.
And that equivalency is here. Yeah. And so that's the curiosity in my question is, you say intuitive, you say from performing in ensembles, but clearly you've studied this, you know how to make it possible for a performer to play a line and have that line be both interesting and fit well with the other lines in both both your kind of, I understand it from improvising side and from a side that says these parts fit together and are harmonically sensible, and they fit inside each other's harmonic series in such a way that I'm not going to get something ugly when I didn't intend it.
All right. Well, that's probably the nicest thing that anyone's ever said about the piece. And the most feedback that I've actually received on it. The thing is, I think if you have a sort of the words of the poetry sort of evoked what I wanted to hear, the sense, the ideas. And I started hearing something immediately when I was reading the piece, when I was reading the poem. And then structurally, I followed the structure of the poem. And there's repetition,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
there's thematic repetition.
Yeah.
There's a sense of interweaving of different lines in a contrapuntal way, canonic imitation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sense of harmony, I think we live in a very beautiful age where there's definite disparate sort of harmonies and disparate sounds and disparate ideas and clashing ideas, but there's also a way to produce a beautiful harmony. I think that from a clash you can get harmony. I don't think the world is done with harmony. It's just a question of how it's represented. So if you are thinking in a tonal direction, it's one thing to embrace the, you know, the contrapuntal ideas of Fuchs and so forth. It's another thing to realize that parallel fourths and parallel fifths are like so valid in today's
mm-hmm.
writing. I mean, look at McCoy Tyner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, people who don't know McCoy Tyner, one of the greatest jazz pianists of all time, who I think has in turn influenced every pianist to come out in the latter half of the 20th century and in the 21st century. Everybody sounds like McCoy. But it's incredible, this use of this sort of these parallel fourths and fifths. I think it's one of the most beautiful sounds. I mean, getting more sort of like with tuning and the music of the spheres and Pythagorean tuning systems and so forth, and listening for the relationships between different instruments and how they can harmonize to the extent that they can harmonize is a very important part of sort of a concept that I think that I have in composition and in improvisation as well.
Do you adjust your instrument's tuning while you play?
It depends on the piece, you mm-hmm. know. If the composer's asking for that, yeah. When I'm improvising, absolutely, all the time. Because there's the whole microtonal spectrum. Uh-huh. I know Robert, my good friend Robert Bonotto over here, through Johnny Reiner.
Microtonal
king. Guru.
And former
right?
guest on our show. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So Johnny Reiner is a good friend and a good guy. And he opened up his world of microtonality to me a couple of years ago. And all the influences that he's talked about. Who is that incredible? I'm not going to think of his name. He lived as a hobo, the great composer.
Harry Parch.
I'm sorry. That's bad that I can't think of Harry Parch's name. But he...
comes with age. It gets worse.
I guess, yeah. I guess so.
Take it from Calvos and then...
So the beautiful thing about composition today is that you can draw from all these influences, but then we're in a postmodern era, right? Where, you know, I mean, Jimi Hendrix marveled at Jimi Hendrix's, Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock.
Well, didn't everybody?
And who hasn't who wasn't, I think, the greatest composer of the 20th century was Igor Stravinsky. As far as I'm concerned, we also mentioned Harry Parch, and there are other great ones. But
name two out of my five. How about that?
Yeah. Well,
Frank Zappa,
yeah, of course. Right. You know, Frank Zappa.
Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra. John Cage, Giannis Zanakis. Those are my five.
You just mentioned Zanakis, another influence.
We were talking about Zanakis last night.
As a matter of fact, if you wanted to put this on, this is a collective improvisation from my Vortex series that I think is very Zanakis influenced. It would be track number 3.
On Zanakian, there.
Zanakian. And there's a lot of microtonality and so forth. Now, if you can hear the Zanakis in there, you know, I guess you're going to be lucky. But I thought about Zanakis when we were working on this together.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
This is great. Fantastic. You're listening to Calvos and Damien in the house on the Non-Pop International Network.
You should see the sheet music form. It's
scoring. I've been trying to do that all night. Thank you.
Homage to Raymond Carver.
Raymond Carver. I was going to say it was fresh off the cutting room floor, but that was kind of the wrong order.
Oh, yes.
Our guest is Todd Purnell. And you said that's the sort of the unedited material that is, you've just
that's
gotten.
Just completely. I just got that from a wonderful sound engineer, David Lee, who recorded my Vortex series two weeks ago, I think that was from. And you have Junko Simons on cello. There's an electronics wonderful guy. He came in. He was on tour. Named Matt Davignon, who's based in Berkeley, and then a new friend, Esther Viola, who was doing oboe mainly, and then she's also doing voice. And I have this series every first Friday of the month at the Outpost 186 in Cambridge.
Is there a Boston scene that's different, say, than a New York scene or a Los Angeles scene?
Well, you know, I mean, I love the New York scene. Oh, my God. It's great.
Why?
You know? Well, you know, I mean, at least I used to. In the 90s, it was cool. But, you know, I think it's changed a lot, you know. It just seems like New York is like the modern music place, right? But in Boston, there's so many great musicians there, and there's a lot happening, you know. I mean, I don't know how to compare it, really. It's just different. It's a little bit different, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also people who just absolutely will not work together inside these circles, or they're friendly, but they don't play together. And then there's like, I don't really understand like what the so-called Boston scene is about. I'm not really sure.
But it doesn't have an uptown downtown like New York. It doesn't have a, you know, separate jazz and classical scenes as heavily as New York, or does it?
Well, you know, I mean, for you to say that you're playing jazz, but you're a classical musician, you know, sort of makes you a pariah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's the same thing vice versa, you know. So, you know, it's, I mean, look, each field is very specialized, and there are certain nuances and certain stylistic things that differ in each world. And I think that, you know, I just want to work as a clarinet player. I just want to play, you know. And, you know, I love to do improvisation. I love to do composition. I love to play classical music. It's just that it's you know, it's funny the way how the worlds are sort of separate. When what I try and do is I like to think about ways of integrating just great music, you know, overall in different areas, you know, like our friend Duke Ellington, whatever.
Speaking of great music, you have a new piece that was created for you by
yes.
Robert Bonotto.
Yep.
Robert and who?
Bonotto.
Oh, Bonotto.
Who's in our audience. And while you're setting up, I'll welcome back our online video listeners on Ustream. We had a little power supply issue that caused the computer to shut down for a while, and it took us a while to get it back. Now it's back, and we're happy to have everyone here again. And I'm going to go move the camera for our guest, Todd Burnell. come sit on the microphone here for a minute and talk about your piece real briefly?
As long as I don't have to sit on the microphone.
Well, no, on it. On it is much more effective than in front of it.
How much was written, and I presume it's all written down, but for the electronics, were they all...
No. That was the improv part of it.
Ah, I see.
And it took me all of 35 minutes two nights ago.
Show off?
Yeah. But there's really not much to it, except for I just thought it might be a nice idea.
Yes, indeed.
It would be probably make the good first movement of a sonatina or something like that.
Have you written for the Todster before?
No. The Todster and I have had... I've been a member of the audience at his Vortex Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
Several times.
But you haven't vortexed yourself?
No, I don't vortex myself anymore. I've been taking the antidepressants for some time.
It's unfortunate because you probably should get back into that field.
Yes, I know, but I just have to wait to buy reinforcements.
Yeah. Writing anything else these days?
Yeah, I'm writing a 2-viola and cello sonata for the violist Don Ehrlich, who used to be of the San Francisco Symphony, and he's starting a trio of 2 violas and a cello mm-hmm. in San Francisco. There's not much written for that combination, so I decided to write for it. There's apparently a few 18th century pieces like that, but probably not very good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure why he made that combination, but... you know, that hasn't prevented people from starting to write for that group. And I'm writing another piece for Todd for 2 clarinets, which would be both clarinets acting and then playing and doing improv in the middle. And I'm working on a piece for bass, trombone, and piano trio for Dave Taylor.
Is that a Boston person?
No, he's in New York. But... whether he's going to play it or not, I don't know. If he listens to this, he probably won't.
Oh, how encouraging.
Yes. I think Todd's ready for another piece.
Tell.
A name. We must have a name.
Always a name.
Timeless classic.
A timeless classic. How appropriate. We play timeless classics from time to time, but we've never played the timeless classic.
The timeless.
Oh, now we have. ASCAP, are you listening? Or BMI, whomever?
Yes, yes, yes. The timeless classic has just been released. Mm-hmm. So go for it, you guys.
Right.
You know? Go for it. So, yeah, thank you, Robert. That was a... Let's go for it, you guys. It started here.
The right? Timeless Classic.
The Timeless Classic. Can you guys put this parts of this thing on right here? Because this is a timeless classic right here. Actually.
Okay.
How long is this?
It's
a joke.
We have
it's a
different.
Joke. It's a joke.
Well, I should have the things, but this is a thing that I wanted to talk about. It's myself. Now I have the marquee. I'm on top this time.
Oh, good.
Myself and my dear friend R. Sarkeesian, who's a great composer.
I thought he was the coach of Notre Dame for a while.
No, that was Aram Saroyan.
Oh, Saroyan, of course. Yes.
Another Armenian. Right? I don't know. Ara is. I don't know much about football, but I used to play actually. But that's
play football and play clarinet. I guess there is a similarity.
I actually quit playing football so I could play the clarinet more seriously. The first track is In Search of Serenity, and it's Ara and I also play in a group called Musinair, and it's Armenian-based folk music by. Have you ever heard of Komitas by any chance?
Not me.
Well, he is a legendary Armenian composer and singer, and he took a lot of the melodic influences of Komitas and infused them in with that project. This is this piece is called In Search of Serenity, and it's R. Sarkeesian on piano and I'm on clarinet.
almost slid one in there. Nope. But we're back with Todd Burnell here on Calvis and Damien in the house on the Non-Pop International Network.
I presume that In Search of Serenity, that's not the adult brand of diaper.
Oh.
I was trying to... I didn't hear it in that.
You know, that's not my kind of search thing.
I am up to my ears in diapers
right
now.
Oh, you're a new, relatively new daddy, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I have this incredible little terrorist living with us. Oh my gosh, the FBI is going to be called. No, his name, he's incredible. We're in love with him, and his name's Luca, and he's the most amazing little dude.
Crumb
ever.
Snatcher.
He's a everything snatcher. Daddy's clarinet snatcher. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was the one who put the bayonet inside the...
Oh, yes, indeed. And apparently
bad fatherhood
had some... I see. And was playing with your effects, too,
I
understand.
I think that's one of the reasons why my wah-wah pedal is destroyed.
Orange juice?
I'm having a hard time. I had something. The thing is, I bust them out because I have this educational thing that I'm coming up with to do a... Because I do a lot of teaching and so forth. So I have an idea. I'm going to start something actually at the Powers Music School in the fall called the Electroacoustic Ensemble. So, you know, I mean, kids, what they have in school, they have band, you know, which is great. Band's great, right? And then they have orchestra. Great, right? Fine, you know. But if you hear the kids talking about it, most of the kids are like rolling their eyes. And they're doing it for the credit and they're sort of going through the motions. Some kids genuinely love it. Those are the kids that, like, as a private lesson teacher, we're like, oh,
yes,
we're
thank
so
you,
thrilled.
Thank you
so much.
This is why we do this.
We're grateful for those wonderful young students, and I have many of them. But there are also kids that are just like, geez, you know, what am I doing this for? And, of course, instruments in the wind ensemble aren't really used in mainstream media. At least you don't see them. You see American Idol. You see, like, singers. You mm-hmm. may see guitars.
Guitar,
you may see an occasional saxophone.
Drums,
maybe.
Once
you know?
In a while, yeah.
Maybe a saxophone, but it's usually a guitar.
You'll
voice.
Get the sax on Letterman, and that's
right.
About
you get
it,
the sax
yeah.
on Letterman, right? And you hear the clarinet on Squidward, you know, from SpongeBob, right? Right. So,
what a good reference.
You know, I work on that with the kids, but there's something where, like, if they get to use these electronics and these effects and looping and so forth, that they're just really excited about. So. You know, I'm trying to...
So this ensemble starts in the schools in the fall, or is it independent? How does this work?
Well, it's something I'm starting at the Powers Music School
where
in Belmont. The director there, Helen Clapp Stevenson, decided to give it a shot. And I'm also developing an idea with a friend of mine to bring it in other schools and so forth. So, you know, we're going to be bringing it elsewhere, maybe even here to Vermont.
Can't
so
you settle down for a while?
I got to make a living.
It's interesting the number of dimensions you kind of have to be part of to make a living as a musician.
Yeah.
I mean, now we've now touched on your fourth one. I mean, we have the composer, the improviser, the freelance for hired gun clarinetist with bayonet, and now we have the teacher.
Yeah, right.
And so not forgetting the parent.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And how does the teaching influence your writing, your improvisation?
Well, I write a lot for the kids
yeah.
all the time. I mean, I think maybe just I'm just it tires me out, kind of, you know, because I'm doing a lot of the same kinds of things. But one of the things that is kind of cool when you're working with kids, in order to get them to learn how to improvise, a lot of kids, you know, you put music in front of them. Kids play it, right? And they're used to that. But a lot of kids, they want to improvise. They want to, you know, play a jazz band. They want to understand what chord symbols are and what they mean. And so, you know, it's an important thing to start out if they read music and they can't really improvise, if they don't want to let themselves improvise. Start by writing cells, little ideas,
mm-hmm.
and outlining chords, showing them approach tones to, you know, different chord tones and so forth. So... I'll write a blues out, or I'll write a, you know, it's a sort of a short, simple melodic thing for them to work on, and hopefully practice. But that's kind of a hard thing to get them to do that.
In terms of, you know, what you teach them, and in terms of what you've written in this last piece, or how you've played in this last piece, can you kind of give our lay listeners a rundown on the multiphonics, what they are, and how you do them, what they are, and because they're very ethereal in there. You're listening to the piece, and I suspect that if you are not familiar with the sound, you thought that there were additional players happening there. Yeah. So tell a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, talk about microtonality and so forth. I mean, this is the ultimate microtone. You know, is the use of like it's sort of a dyad, sometimes maybe even a triad. You can get out. But it's basically you have a tube and it's physics, and what you're doing is you're sort of either half covering holes or using alternative fingerings to get these sounds out that are sort of, they sound like, you know, something from another planet, really, you know.
So you're playing, in effect, multiple tones at the same time.
You're able to get, yeah.
When you're a beginning clarinetist, this is undesirable.
Yeah, when you're a beginning clarinetist, you want to, you know, when you're doing, as you sort of learn to get outside of yourself as a professional or an advanced student or something like that, maybe you want to experiment with going back to some of the things that you used to do when you were a kid. And then what you realize is that, you know, what I try and do with my students is I try and encourage them that if they squeak, guess what? That's the higher partial that's coming up. Mm-hmm. That's a high note that you just got. You don't realize it. You just got a high D, and see how easy the high notes can be to get out. If you can squeak, you can play high notes.
What a great philosophy.
I know you want to run with that one, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, the reference to the sirens or something in there.
Yeah, that's right. Plus, you once did play clarinet, did you not? A very brief career.
It was interrupted by failure. Exactly.
I see. Todd Burnell's our guest here on Calvus Damien. Show number 555.
It's about time. I was waiting for that for 554 shows.
Yes. So you're gonna do another little workout, maybe
absolutely.
Something a little bit more energetic. You said you wanted to approach that minimalist take again, give it another try.
Yeah.
So, yeah.